Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, April 8th, 2024. I'm senior producer Lou DeVizio. It may be less than 50 days since this year's legislative session wrapped, but Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is pushing hard for a return to the roundhouse. The governor told the Santa Fe New Mexican that she was leaning 80-20 towards announcing a special session centered on what she calls public safety measures. Four previously introduced bills are at the front of Lujan Grisham's agenda, including legislation that would restrict panhandling. I had a chance to speak with the governor to discuss her plans and also to ask whether she believes that she has the votes to get what she wants done. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, thank you so much for joining me on New Mexico in Focus.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the work that you do and always happy to participate in giving updated information to the public.
Yeah, thank you. So we're here to talk about a special session or the prospects of one. Last week, you spoke with Inez Russell Gomez from the Santa Fe New Mexican and told her you were about 80% on calling one. Have you gotten to 100% yet as we speak here on Wednesday?
I haven't, and I think it bears talking about why. I mean, it's a decision I can make. I have the authority to do that as governor in the state of New Mexico. So why not just decide? You know, part of it is, I want to be successful for the public, right? We have a lot of public safety issues that still require, in my view, immediate and dramatic attention. And what I want is these strategies to get through a very narrow, very tight special session. I've participated with many governors in special sessions that are all over the map, and then nothing gets done. And then you have even less opportunity to get people back to a good baseline for the next general session. So I'm still about 80 there, but I think what I could do today and want to do, frankly, is we've been meeting with legislators more often. We are drafting proposals, and I'd love to talk to you about the five or so proposals that we think, if passed and implemented immediately, could have a dramatic effect on the continuation of public safety issues that New Mexicans are unfortunately well aware of.
Yeah, let's talk about the specific measures. What exactly are you trying to get passed if you do call a special session?
So there were two measures that didn't get through. One that I think had a little more momentum, but it was still, I mean, it's not like it had broad support and was missing, you know, one or two votes at the very end, but it was at least moving. That one's called criminal competency. Now, what this measure does is it allows a judge in a setting where a particular defendant, a repeat offender, drug issues, theft issues, potentially even a violent offender, reactions to alcohol, drugs, trauma, maybe living on the streets, may not, they can send them through a drug court. They can do outpatient treatment. Nobody ever sticks with it, right? You're right back in. It's a revolving door. A competency bill allows a judge to identify, based on the evidence, that they don't meet those competency issues. And if one of the appropriate measures is to do a placement in, say, a behavioral health treatment facility or drug addiction facility, they can do that for an extended amount of time. The data shows that when you have a sentence like that, by the time you detox, get the right support, get the right medication, get the right diagnoses, spend 90 days or sometimes more, we see around the country that that's having the impact that we need. While we can do behavioral health in jail, it is not a conducive, long-lasting intervention. And what we want are interventions that stop this revolving door. That is a critical tool. The judges want it. We had some expert testimony from former Metro and District Court judges. I think that bill's more ready than some of the others. Second one is that a felon in possession, we want to make sure that we lift that to a second degree felony. We want to extend the penalties. And the case that I've made to some legislators who might say to me, maybe there's not enough body of evidence that suggests that that's a deterrent. And I don't know that I agree with that, but let's say they're right. And I was to do that research. But if you get someone who's continued to commit crimes, who isn't meeting the terms of their felony probation, who has a firearm. They're not out committing crimes for that additional 5 to 7 years. And in a city and in a state that's seeing high crime levels, this seems to me to be a productive measure of both accountability and public safety on the other side. Those are both bills that were introduced, but did not get upstairs. So I'm particularly interested in those two. Third one that is going to take more work was introduced in the session. A lot of questions about how it works, and it is a pedestrian safety bill, or basically a traffic safety bill that gets at some of the panhandling on our busy intersections. There are several municipalities that in fact have produced legislation that has been upheld in court. That's been the issue about whether or not you're violating a First Amendment right. The Espanola city bill or statute ordinance, let me say that right. This ordinance looks like it's got all the foundational underpinnings of a constitutional measure that creates better public safety in those spaces and allows us to handle that a bit better.
Can I ask about that?
Go ahead.
Sure. Sorry to cut you off there.
Yeah.
Can I ask about that a little bit more?
Yeah.
The underpinnings that you talk about, the constitutional concerns, to my understanding, link back to a 2015 Supreme Court ruling, Reed versus Town of Gilbert, which cites panhandling as a matter of protected speech. Why do you think that this bill is different enough to be constitutional?
Because it has a segue to public safety. So like anything, including free speech, you can't eliminate panhandling, but you can minimize public safety impacts related to panhandling. And that's the difference here. So the measures that were brought or the issue before that particular court in that particular court setting is that they tried to eliminate panhandling in a community. You can't eliminate it. And I am also interested, Lou, in this. And I don't know that it will translate into a special session request, but you know, like any other businesses, panhandling is a business. There may be other constitutional regulations that you could place. So you got to get a license, they would be free, you could do a background check, you could think about placements that maximize traffic safety, pedestrian safety, public safety, but you're not eliminating the free speech constitutionally protected requirements or interfering with a business model, if you will. There are a couple of communities that have done that. I don't know enough about those results to suggest that that should be before a special session. But I do think we need to start being more open-minded about what creates safety, opportunity, minimizes high-risk, vulnerable populations, and the like. And that does require policymakers in the room. So those are three provisions that I didn't get upstairs that I think are worth revisiting, that I think can have a monumental impact on a variety of public safety issues. Okay. Here are two more, if you can stand me.
Sure.
Two more, Lou, that I think can really have a make an impact here. Like the criminal competency, we should do a civil commitment. And so in the debate that we have as New Mexicans, another policymaker, another elected leader, dismantled behavioral health, then we've been suffering through trying to put it back, COVID and any number of emergencies. And there's a sense, and it's true, that there's not enough entry points. But now the standards for managed care organizations is they're paid to solve that problem. So they can, there's a number of opportunities that we have through a new contract relationship and set of measures and accountability aspects with them. But that's not really the issue for public safety issues. The issue is if you are, as an example, living unhoused, and you have violent tendencies, and you're self-medicating, and you're involved in retail theft, the right, I don't want this person in jail. What we want is this person to get successfully treated in a behavioral health setting, both get the addiction dealt with and deal with whatever that mental health issue is. These are individuals that cannot go by themselves, will not go. I can't tell you how many parents I talk to of 18-year-olds. They're not unhoused per se, and they won't go get substance abuse treatment. You can't make them go. California has passed a civil commitment bill, again, that I think shows great promise for a state like New Mexico with a growing behavioral health population situation. And it allows for up to 90 days, maybe twice, where you're committed to a program or a facility. Two, it creates runways and requirements for local bodies of government to create support services and to be responsible for that social services behavioral health network or infrastructure. And I'd like to see New Mexico pass that bill. I don't think we have another year and a half to wait, given the number of addicted populations we are seeing not be able to manage their lives and have impact on the quality of lives of other New Mexicans and create either because they're targets of crime or engaged in crime, eating, drugs, alcohol, whatever that is. But I think that is a very valuable measure that New Mexico needs today, frankly, more than ever.
Okay. With that bill in particular, would this be a mandatory commitment for 90 days in lieu of a criminal penalty that the defendant would be able to choose? Or how exactly would that work?
No, this would be something that's totally on the civil side. So a parent, a police officer, a emergency room physician. These are folks could identify populations, would have to go before a court so that you've got due process and protection to the individual. But it allows for under, if you would meet the criteria of the statute, that you would benefit and can't make the decision on your own, you could get a civil commitment for up to a certain amount of time. It can't be forever, with very stringent due process protections required. You know, we went from a place in the 60s, Lou, where everyone could be committed and it was awful and inappropriate and unlawful and illegal, unconstitutional. And then we just closed them all for bad care, bad treatment, and unconstitutional placements. And we've built nothing in this country since then. And the kind of drugs like the fentanyl cocktails create such impacts on our brains that you need very intensive therapeutic, medically designed interventions in a 24-hour care setting. And that's what all the data shows. If you're sick and you're medically, you're self-medicating, you can't make those decisions. It has to be made by other individuals. And so I'm very interested in this particular piece of legislation.
Okay. On those specific bills, we have the criminal competency, felon in possession, the panhandling that you're classifying as more of a public safety roadway situation, civil commitment. You've talked about some anecdotal evidence, but what are the specific problems that you're hoping to eliminate with those four measures?
Well, you know, a growing population that is unhoused or drug addicted without any services, support systems for families that we're not putting people in jail is the only treatment modality that's available for these high-risk populations, that where we've got complaints, it's happened to me personally, I'm going to bet it's happened to members of your team where you work, where someone is chasing the car or outside with a crowbar, a machete, a 2x4, trying to push into you with a shopping cart. These are real risks that are causing the potential increased issues for road wage and any number of other issues. So I'm looking to attenuate that behavior. If you're also looking at the retail theft, I would say I haven't been anywhere in Albuquerque at a pharmacy or a small strip mall store or shop that I haven't seen a theft in progress in 18 to 24 months straight anywhere. I just did it yesterday and I saw two. And what happens is the people in the store are on high alert. The people also trying to shop are on high alert and intimidated. We've seen guns and firearms, and that's the same thing, and knives and other weapons drawn. I saw someone yesterday that brought in several animals. They got into a fight in the store. A child was screaming and running. It seems to me broken windows, broken doors, people who can't feel unsafe working there. This has to be interrupted by looking at ways to help people get better and to maybe get at some of the root causes, thereby being able to focus on some of the more serious violent crimes in the community. And it looks to me that all of these measures by other states who are also looking and utilizing these measures, that it does have an impact in helping people, being compassionate, being evidence-based, and then to focus your public safety teams, police, and first responders on the more serious issues so that we're not stretched so thin, because that's also a major issue that New Mexicans are grappling with. If you call the police, are there police to show up? And we should talk about all the bills that are passed that I think are already helping and will continue to help. But to say that we have enough police officers on the streets, there are not. And we have to keep building that infrastructure to do right by public safety in New Mexico.
The measures that you and impacts that you just laid out, could you talk a little bit more about the tangible impacts that New Mexicans could expect if any of these measures were to pass?
Well, less people on the streets who appear to be high risk, more people getting treatment, so it's not a revolving door in our criminal justice system, more access points for behavioral health because they're being built by local bodies of government and medical professionals in the state in real time, opportunities for us to build meaningful, affordable housing to deal with, so as people get treated, you know, they have a place to land that's productive and fair and supportive. All of that has a, I think, immeasurable impact on both public safety and on quality of life for everyone in New Mexico. And I believe they do have immediate impact. I mean, if you just hear the testimony from the judges who see the same individuals in the courtroom over and over again, or if you talk to police officers, they will tell you that they get called, someone's been threatened, they pick up somebody who is has a clearly drug addiction issue, test positive for drugs, and is before the court. It's the 10th time. They're misdemeanors. They're right back out and commit another misdemeanor. And we have this revolving door. So police say, I'm not gonna engage in this community issue anymore because it makes no difference. And it grows, and it's growing exponentially. And that has to be interrupted in meaningful ways. And again, it also allows our first responders to focus on some of the more serious patterns of crime and some of the more serious violent crimes in our community. And I do think New Mexicans, I mean, I am very pleased that the legislature passed the 7-day waiting period for a background check for firearms. No firearms in polling places also saves lives, also creates public safety efforts that are meaningful to the general public. The no bond hold isn't quite pretrial detention, but those more serious offenders get held pending their trials so that we're not creating situations where more crimes are committed while we're waiting for someone's a criminal trial after an initial arrest. I mean, all of that has been building in every single New Mexico community. And these are measures that can stop that. Lastly, our return to work for police and firefighters and the amount of money that we're able to do retentions and new positions should continue. We've put more than I think 500 officers statewide into new positions, and we've got the largest cadet training classes, you know, we've seen back to back to back. These are going to create opportunities for us to have sufficient community policing in each of our communities. And we do not have that currently. And it's available for everyone. Tribal police, sheriffs, city police, state police. It's available for every police jurisdiction.
Okay. Getting back to this special, and you mentioned a little bit at the top of the conversation about the conversations with legislative leadership, how those are going, making sure that you have enough votes. What do you expect to change in the next few weeks that hasn't happened in about the last 3 months since you kind of tested the waters with the idea of a session? Are you having productive conversations with both members of your own party and the GOP?
I believe so. And we are working on, it's occurring, work groups by chairs of key committees have already begun preparing for a special session call so that we've got bills that there's more agreement than not. So that as you go into a special session, people have been spending real time and participating in the drafting and final documents for presentation to the legislature if in fact we do a special session. And that's what's different, is that we're just focused on a handful of bills. Everyone has notice. The key committee chairs and experts are already working on them. And you have a much more focused, concentrated effort and assuming success. And we've had, by and large, very successful special sessions. Then those measures are ready for implementation the second after the special session ends, right? The second I sign them, they're ready to go, which means we're building and doing something immediate. If you wait for a 60-day, and then those measures often aren't emergencies, they don't put an emergency clause on it and meet the requirements for that, then they're not available for implementation until the next July. You're talking about a full year plus from right now, plus that runway for implementation, which is 3 months or so. So the way I'm looking at it, you lose another year and a half to a year and 6 months or more. I said that already, a year, almost 2 years. And we don't have enough time with all of the things. I just see all this risk building, and the call volumes around the state speak for themselves.
So what's the time frame for a deciding that you want to call a special session, and how long a special session could last?
Typically, I'll do the latter question first. A special session shouldn't last more than, you know, 3 days-ish. It's going to depend. Depends on if we agree as a team on 3 bills or 5 bills. But, you know, in that a week, no more, but it should be less. So you try to get it. For me, 3 to 4 days is enough time to do credible work. And then I would like it to happen right after the primary. So my decision about calling that really does need to happen in the next few weeks. And by then, I will have seen the latest drafts of the measures that you and I are talking about so that I can begin to do exactly that, a vote count about where we are and how people are feeling that these are measures that can actually make a difference in our communities.
Okay. So end of the month, safe ballpark for a deadline?
Safe ballpark. Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, before I let you go, I spoke to the state land commissioner on the show last week, and she told me if you were to call a special session that she'd be knocking on your door to have a rate increase for oil and tax leases. Are you considering adding that proposal specifically, but any others? And how do you manage that? Because I would imagine she's not the only one.
No, well, it's only going to be a public safety special session. So if I'm missing a public safety idea, I am more than interested in hearing about those right now. Certainly, we're reaching out to our other law enforcement stakeholders, not just legislators. They're participating, right? So DAs, PDs, judges, you know, a broader community of experts. And while I'm compelled by the things that our statewide electeds and others are working on, those aren't emergencies in the same context. And I really want this to be a public safety special session. And quite frankly, you know, the public, in my view, appetite is for really significant focus there, given the issues that people are trying to manage in their businesses, their personal life, and making sure that their families are safe and they're safe in their neighborhoods. This is what they want us to work on. So it's not that I don't think that proposal has merit, but not in a special session, in this special session.
Sure. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, thank you so much. Thanks to the governor for making time to speak with me. Now, as we wait for a final decision on a special session, correspondent Gwyneth Dolan hosts a roundtable discussion with UNM political science professor Timothy Krebs and Daniel Williams, policing policy advocate with the ACLU of New Mexico. They'll dive into the real and perceived problems the governor says that she wants to address in a special session, the potential pitfalls of those proposals, and the politics of public safety in our state. Here's Gwyneth.
Thanks, Lou. Let's first set the stage here. National poll numbers show people across the country think crime is worse than it is. But there is no question, crime in New Mexico is higher than it is in other places. The governor just said retail theft is out of control. It's complicated, though. The latest Albuquerque statistics show that property crimes are actually down a little bit over the past 6 years. But the number of assaults and murders is about the same. Here's the one big thing that has changed. Drug offenses have doubled, right? APD calls these crimes against society, and I think that is a useful way of thinking about it right now. At the same time, the number of homeless people has risen in almost every state across the country. But New Mexico had the biggest increase, and that's a 50% increase in the number of homeless people on the street over the past decade. So the first question is, what are the actual problems we need to solve here? Tim, let me go to you first.
Well, you know, these issues are really complex, and you know, you could say, well, we'll take a stab at the crime problem, or take a stab at the housing problem, the homelessness problem, the drug addiction problem, mental health, et cetera. But really, these things are together. They're correlated with each other. And so, you know, it's a big, complex problem. Crime is associated with poverty. Poverty is a predictor of homelessness. And so, you know, and other kinds of societal ills. And so these problems are really sort of interconnected.
We can't really pull one out without...
That's exactly right. I mean, and certainly when we talk about crime, for example, the perception of crime is always higher than the actual crime numbers. It just always is. And while it's clear that New Mexico, that the crime problem, the crime rates nationally and also in New Mexico have come down, certainly nationally, substantially in the last couple of years, people's perception of it is that it's really, really out of control. And New Mexico is above the national average on all these different crime indicators, but it has come down a bit.
Daniel, do you agree?
I do. I think it's a really important point to look at all of these as a holistic issue, that we can't just tackle one thing at a time and expect things to get better. And I think it's also important for us to recognize that we can't take the same approach that has failed us over and over again, fueling mass incarceration and harming our communities. We can't arrest our way out of any of the problems that you just named. We have to be looking at what are the root causes, what are driving these issues in our communities. And it's not going to work to just arrest everyone and throw them in jail. That's just going to make the problem worse, as we've seen for my whole life and really longer.
And I think the governor in the interview we just saw echoed some of that. And she said root causes. She said that's what she wants to do. She wants to call lawmakers back to Santa Fe this summer after the primary, notably, to pass more laws related to crime and public safety. She says we need to, we can't arrest our way out, but she did say she wanted to look at the root causes of crime and invest in communities. she did say tough on crime strategies haven't worked. That's pretty common Democratic, you know, perspective. But Tim, you know, let's talk about what's on the street here. You work at UNM. Mm-hmm. You know what it's like on Central right now, right? I was stopped at a light the other day, and I saw a guy leaning against the light pole to steady himself while he shot up. You know, what kind of pressure does this, do these visuals, these situations, what kind of pressure does this put on politicians?
Oh, you know, this is, I mean, politicians are reacting to what they're hearing from their constituents. And it's these kinds of experiences that constituents are relaying to them. It's not exactly, you know, there's research that shows that, you know, it's not necessarily the sort of, you know, the rhetoric that politicians use in elections that's causing people to think that crime is worse than it is. It's actually the public itself has been leading, public opinion on crime has been leading politicians to take harder and harder stances with respect to criminal justice and crime fighting issues. But
that's
this is
interesting to hear you put it that way, because I might have suspected the opposite.
Yeah,
but it's
right.
The public pushing politicians to do this.
Yeah, research that shows that as opposed to the other way around since the 1950s. And so these kinds of visuals are the things that the public is reacting to. They see this and they're you know, rightfully sort of outraged, I think. It's an emotional kind of experience that you have when you see that.
Yeah.
They then will contact their legislators or, you know, write letters to the editor or whatever, or respond to pollsters that, you know, crime's out of control.
Yeah, and I was having some of these same thoughts when I was watching her do her State of the State address in January at the opening of the session. I thought, oh, there's so much about crime in this speech. I know she feels like she has to talk about this, but what is she going to say, right? And let's do a little, you know, flashback. During that State of the State address, she laid out her public safety agenda. It was a sizable part of the speech. She wanted 10 things: an assault weapon ban, raising the gun buying age to 21, a 14-day waiting period before buying a gun, increased penalties for felons in possession of a firearm, a ban on guns in parks and playgrounds, allowing cops to file red flag orders, enhanced penalties for commercial burglary, pretrial detention for violent and repeat offenders, mandatory treatment, we're going to come back to this, for people repeatedly entering the judicial system, and restrictions on panhandling. As we all saw, she did not get that list accomplished, but she got the ban. She got a ban on firearms at polling places, wasn't actually on her list. A 7-day waiting period, not 14. Keeping suspects locked up if they reoffend while they're out awaiting trial on a first charge. And increased penalties for second-degree murder and attempted second-degree murder. And now she wants more. She says this is an emergency. The public wants something done. Worth noting, also an election year for state lawmakers. Just putting that out there. So is this a real emergency, or is this a political emergency, or both?
Well, I think I also live in Albuquerque. I'm seeing the same things that we've already talked about, that everyone is seeing. And so I think there are real issues, and we all want to live in a safe community. I don't think that the emergency rhetoric that the governor is using is especially helpful for thinking about these issues. These are long-term systemic issues. We didn't get here overnight. This wasn't something that we started having substance use issues in this country last year. We started having homelessness in this state 2 years ago.
Although, to be fair, those numbers are both up a lot recently.
They're up. There's a long story of how we got to that place where those numbers are increasing to the extent that they are. And so this idea that all of a sudden we just need to come to Santa Fe for 3 days or maybe a week and we can pass a bunch of legislation and we're just going to fix it all, it's really not the way these issues work. And some of the things that she's talking about are really complex, thorny legal issues that take a lot of care and attention to solve.
Now, again, she said she wants to call this, if she does, after the primary, and everyone's kind of too busy to come to Santa Fe while they're out campaigning and doing their real jobs. But what are the dynamics for state lawmakers who are probably thinking ahead to the mailers they want to put out, the mailers other people are going to put out against them, the TV ads, that kind of stuff? What's at stake for them?
Well, certainly for incumbents who are in districts that are, you know, competitive, you know, the crime issue is one that they, you know, they could be potentially vulnerable on if they haven't done the things that people think they should do with respect to sort of being tough on crime, addressing the issue. Because, I mean, it is a very serious concern in the state. New Mexico is always like number one or number two in terms of being a very violent place. And so there's no ignoring that. And I think people are rightfully sort of frustrated with sort of how the criminal justice system works and how policing and crime fighting works and sort of the lack of response in some way from elected officials. There's always a fine line, of course, between, you know, sort of being tough on crime. It's sort of the lock everyone up approach certainly has not worked. I mean, that is absolutely clear.
I want to segue here to panhandling, yeah, because in terms of something that could change the optics of crime quickly, it could be restricting panhandling. You know, she painted in that interview a pretty scary picture of people with machetes and 2x4s. Okay, I haven't seen that, but I get it. It, as a lady in my car alone a lot, there are some times when I've been a little bit freaked out. But Daniel, I know you're going to tell me that civil libertarians don't like this.
Well, civil libertarians don't like this. I think also as a person of conscience, I don't like this. I think it's important to know, the governor did talk about people chasing people with machetes. It's important to note that that's already illegal.
Okay, well, fair enough.
And that a panhandling ban is not narrowly tailored to address those issues. And so the governor mentioned that there have been First Amendment challenges to panhandling ordinances in the past. She believes that the proposal that she is putting forward might pass constitutional muster. It's probably not going to surprise you that the people that I'm talking to don't share that assessment. But regardless of the sort of legal First Amendment constitutional issues, there's also a sort of a fundamental values question here for me and for us at the ACLU, which is that I think we can all agree that homelessness is one of the moral crises of our times, and that it's unacceptable that we live in a country where so many people don't have the resources that they need to shelter themselves. And so the idea that criminalizing people for activity that they are undertaking to just give themselves the resources they need to survive, that is going to solve that problem, it's just wrongheaded. We know that one period of incarceration makes someone 7 times more likely to experience homelessness. Multiple incarcerations make someone more than 13 times more likely to experience homelessness. So the idea of criminalizing this behavior, criminalizing people for asking for money on the street, that's just going to make the problem worse, and it's not going to really help us address this problem. That is something that weighs on, I think, all of our consciences.
You make an eloquent case, Daniel. I want to move on to criminal competency and civil commitment. The governor gave an example of someone who is homeless, has mental health issues, violent tendencies. They're making the pain go away with fentanyl. Now they're stealing stuff to get by and get food and buy drugs. And now they're charged with, say, aggravated assault or shoplifting, but they're too messed up to stand trial. So what she wants is, if a judge finds they're incompetent to stand trial because they have mental health or behavioral health issues that are preventing that, then a judge can send them to treatment. She says forcing them to go to treatment would allow them to get that addiction dealt with and address the underlying mental health issues in order to stand trial. That's one thing. Another bill would allow, say, a family with an adult child who's got a drug problem and is totally out of control to petition the court to send them to treatment, even if they don't really want to go. Now, they'd have to, you know, there's some due process, and we'll get back to that. But Tim, You know, what do you think of this idea? It's pretty in the weeds. This isn't something I think a lot of people think about, but would this work? Is this a good idea to use these two methods to get more people into treatment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it strikes me as a kind of middle ground between doing nothing at all and throwing everybody in jail. Right, and so you take people and you know people. This is part of the frustration that people have with respect to the criminal justice system and being able to hold people who have been accused of committing criminal acts and so forth. You know, having them back out on the streets and doing more, you know, being engaged in more criminal activity. I mean, that's a big part of people's frustration, I think, with respect to the status quo on criminal justice. So it strikes me as a bit more of a middle ground, but there are clear constitutional issues there, just as there are in panhandling regulations.
Give me a 30-second reaction to that idea. Distill it.
This is so complicated and big, and it really needs more than 30 seconds now and more than 3 days this summer. We need a long...
She says she's working with lawmakers in these working groups, and this did come a little bit through last session.
It did. I was in every single committee where these bills were heard, and I would not have characterized that these bills as having momentum this last session. I would not share the governor's assessment there. We need to have public defenders, people who... like us, who care about the Constitution and civil liberties, people who represent marginalized communities, they all need to be at the table, and they all are at the table working to do something that could be really transformative.
But maybe too fast for your...
Maybe too fast. We need to really get this right.
Now, the governor, the last thing I want to talk about is the governor says there aren't enough cops on the street. Probably a lot of people would agree. You know, maybe it doesn't feel like there's enough cops on the street with the number of people we see on, you know, out there. To be clear, there is no empirical evidence that more cops equals less crime. Do we need more cops? I know you're going to say no, but tell me why.
We don't need more cops, and we don't need more criminalization. And so what we need to be really looking at is directing our resources to solving the problems. And when there are cases that don't need a police response, we need to be doing things like what Albuquerque is doing and what Las Cruces is doing with non-police responses, Albuquerque Community Safety and Project Light.
Non-police response. What do you think?
I think we need to do more with respect to non-police response. And I think what Albuquerque has done and other communities have done is a really a positive step. But I would disagree that I think more cops is a good thing in terms of crime fighting. I think there's clear evidence that shows that there, you know, where you have additional police, you're going to have lower crime rates, you're going to have lower property crime rates, especially in violent crime rates. But there's a balance there too. How do you direct those resources? And targeting those resources to the sort of the habitual offenders and the small group of people that are actually engaged in crime, as opposed to targeting those resources to panhandlers per se, they're not the ones really committing crime. What they create is a kind of public safety issue that I think is really important and needs to be addressed, for not only for motorists and cyclists and what have you, but also for them. I mean, for the people who are doing the panhandling. But in any case, the bigger issues are on sort of habitual criminals, the small number of people that are engaged in a disproportionate number of crimes. And additional police resources can help with that.
And I think what we saw her saying was kind of what you just said, but also panhandling. She was like, we need to get rid of these things that are caused by drugs and mental health so that we can deal with the bigger issues. But then she also wants to get rid of this optics problem a little bit.
Yes, because it's a symbol. It's an optics issue. It's something that people and elected officials can point to as, you know, the public and elected officials can point to that and say this is part and parcel of the broader crime and disorder sort of issue in communities.
That is all we have time for this conversation, but thank you so much. You both gave me a lot to think about. Tim, Daniel, we really appreciate having you with us, and we will be watching as this special session gets fired up. Maybe, maybe not. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast this week. Be sure to follow along with us on our social media pages during the week. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, April 8th, 2024. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.